giving Putin what he wants today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump unveils a new national security strategy based in part on the notion that Russia is a great power in a global competition with the U.S. This Russia watcher thinks that's a bad idea.
It's basically, in a way, giving Putin exactly what he wants. He has wanted great power status for as long as he has been president of Russia.
Also, a reporter travels to a part of Nigeria scarred by violence, especially against women, and finds a different story. Young men willing to make a change. Like the guy about to get married who says he wants to share the housework.
He wanted to change diapers. He wanted to do the dishes. He wanted to help cooking and cleaning and that kind of thing.
That and much more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you along with us this Monday. We start today, as we've done a lot recently, focusing on something unusual that President Trump has said. Only this time it was not a jolting tweet or a sharp policy reversal. Instead, the president laid out his administration's national security strategy. It's part of a process that's required by Congress every 2 years, but many past presidents have not done it in their first year in the White House. Trump's just-unveiled security strategy emphasizes one of his main campaign themes.
With every decision and every action, we are now putting America first.
Trump's new direction includes turning away from priorities of his predecessor. Climate change, for example, was seen as a big security threat under President Obama, but to Trump, it's not a threat at all. The president instead struck his familiar themes of securing America's borders and building up American economic power.
Economic vitality, growth, and prosperity at home is absolutely necessary for American power and influence abroad. Any nation that trades away its prosperity for security will end up losing both.
If you're old enough to remember the Cold War, parts of the president's speech sounded strangely familiar because he seemed to revive the concept of great power rivalries.
This strategy recognizes that whether we like it or not, we are engaged in a new era of competition. We accept that vigorous military, economic, and political contests are now playing out all around the world.
Trump said America will stand up for itself like never before in the face of rogue regimes, terrorist groups, transnational criminal networks, and those rival countries.
We also face rival powers, Russia and China, that seek to challenge American influence, values, and wealth. We will attempt to build a great partnership with those and other countries, but in a manner that always protects our national interest.
Still, Trump continues to suggest a friendlier relationship with at least one of those rivals. He mentioned his phone call over the weekend with Russian President Vladimir Putin, saying that U.S. intelligence provided to the Russians about a planned attack might have saved thousands of lives. It's not clear where the president got that information about lives saved. We'll hear more about that intelligence sharing, though, in a few minutes. Let's turn first to reporter Natalia Antonova. She spent much of her life in Russia and other parts of the former Soviet Union, including most of the last decade. She says Trump's positioning of Russia as once again a rival superpower is a big mistake.
This is a disgrace, and it's basically, in a way, giving Putin exactly what he wants. He has wanted great power status for as long as he has been president of Russia, or, you know, prime minister, it doesn't matter. He was always running the country. And I really do think that this is a mistake, and it's another sign that Trump is just failing at his job.
Do you disagree with the idea that we're basically in a Cold War situation with Russia right now?
Yeah, I mean, I really do disagree with that. I think it's a very different world than the one that we had during the Cold War. It's got more variables in it. You know, Russia, in losing the Cold War, has taken up this revanchist position against the United States. And when we're saying, well, we're back to the Cold War, it means that we're giving Russia exactly what it wants. And it will just introduce more instability down the line. And it will embolden Putin more, I'm sure. My gut feeling is that this will embolden Putin.
How do you feel about Russia being named a top threat to the global status quo and U.S. interests?
I think that Russia is definitely a threat, and I think Russia makes no secret of this. You know, the thing is that, but you also have to look at it objectively. Look at the fact that when it comes to actual warfare, Russia's going after the weak. You know, we have the Ukraine situation and we have Syria. And I think this tells you a lot about where Russia is militarily, where it is strategically. I do think that on one level, you know, knowing our current president, knowing his obsessions, I think that he sees the fact that Russia has the world's biggest nuclear arsenal as some kind of great feat. I think he has a thing about nuclear weapons. I think he just, you know, he has this military fetish, right? And I think that he has this very skewed perception of what Russia is versus what it actually is.
So as long as Trump is in the White House and Putin is president of Russia, does it matter to you personally if Washington and Moscow have a good relationship?
The thing is, they haven't had a good relationship for such a long time that, you know, I'm not counting on it to suddenly be good again tomorrow. It's just not going to happen.
Do you wonder how Trump's speech today may affect the way people see you in this country?
Well, I mean, no, I really don't. I feel that preconceived notions about, you know, Slavic women, for example, have always existed. This has nothing to do with anything that any president says. I do think that in Russia, anti-Americanism is much stronger than any kind of Russophobia over here. And I feel like when I was in Russia, like I actually, you know, I felt it. I felt that sense of like wanting to be cautious. And when I speak English to my child on the playground, I would catch like side eye from the other parents and I would be like, are they going to start something now? Like there is that element to it. I don't feel that nearly as much. I really haven't felt it as much since I've been back. And my child here, like in New York, he usually speaks to me in Russian. And you know, nobody's going to give him side eye. Nobody cares. I feel like Americans just care less about other parts of the world. Russians, of course, care more.
Do you remember in the 2012 campaign when Mitt Romney said that for him, Russia was the biggest national security problem in the world?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So do you feel that today, like in some way, that's come true, at least in the eyes of Donald Trump?
Well, it's complicated because the thing about Russia, I'm a writer, so I look at this evolving situation with Russia in terms of a narrative. And if I were to sit down and write a novel about it, I would say, well, this will be a novel about unintended consequences, because this is what always happens with Russia. They're very good at short-term strategic kind of planning, but short-term. As far as long-term, Russia has no strategy, it has no national idea, and it really doesn't have a political system anymore, because I don't think that having a single politician in an enormous country, you have one guy, Vladimir Putin, who has any kind of respect, who has all the power. He's the only consensus figure in that entire country. In that country, people don't trust their institutions. They don't even know or care about their governors. They could care less about their mayors. It's all down to Putin. So when you have that kind of system, it is very hard to plan anything long term.
I know you're far away from Moscow there in New York, but do you think it will annoy the Kremlin that Trump has lumped them in with China as the big national security concerns for the U.S.?
I think it will annoy them, yes, but I think it will also delight them because they want to be taken seriously. They want to be seen as, you know, a force to be reckoned with. So maybe outwardly they will say, oh, well, you know, this is incorrect, or they will once again complain about how Trump is just being pressured into saying these things by Congress or by Mattis. But I feel like on the inside, they will be rejoicing.
Writer and reporter Natalia Antonova, thanks very much for your thoughts, Natalia.
Thank you.
Whatever approach the new U.S. national security strategy means about the relationship between Moscow and Washington, it seems the two countries are still cooperating on terrorism. As we heard earlier, Vladimir Putin called Donald Trump yesterday to thank the CIA for a tip that Putin says prevented a planned suicide bombing in the Russian city of St. Petersburg. For a reality check on this part of the U.S.-Russia relationship, we spoke with Juliet Kayyem, a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. I asked her first about that alleged plot.
So we don't know a lot, but what we do know is that it was an ISIS-inspired attack to target St. Petersburg during the day. So we would have assumed that it would have been high casualty event. And that's basically all we know. One has to believe just from the readouts, two things. One is that the United States might have picked up what we call signal intelligence. In other words, it's unlikely that we have better human intelligence in Russia than the Russians do. And then the second is we just don't know how, let's just say, how strong organized how imminent this alleged terror attack was. Putin has every reason to come out publicly to arrest people he views as enemies of the state. I think the United States should be more suspicious of that kind of victory lap.
Yeah. And from what you know, Juliet, of the Russian FSB, their intel agency, why wouldn't they have announced this when the plot was foiled a few days ago instead of a phone call from Putin to Trump yesterday?
Yeah, and that's where I think the story gets really curious. And I have to be careful. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I just want to lay out what is unusual about this. Intelligence is shared amongst enemies as well as allies for a variety of reasons. We have a mutual interest with Russia in not having ISIS-inspired attacks in either our country or in Russia or anywhere in the world for that matter. So intelligence is being shared sort of across diplomatic line. So it's we could say, look, we don't like China, but we're going to share intelligence with them, or we don't like Russia and we'll share intelligence with them. So I think to come out so publicly is unique on Putin's part, one, because it wasn't time to the sort of arrest themselves. It sort of came out of the blue on a Sunday, just a few days after they had had a previous Donald Trump and Putin had had a previous conversation. And it really did disclose at least, you know, the extent to which we are sharing intelligence and may have exposed to ISIS or other terrorist groups the extent to which American intelligence agencies are actually surveying them. Those are all things that you wouldn't normally want out there in the public debate.
And in this day and age, the CIA helping the FSB, does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. I think on we have to separate the sort of operational aspects of intelligence, law enforcement, diplomacy with the sort of more sort of, you know, Twittersphere or public diplomacy. Across the board, everyone from first responders to intelligence agents to diplomats are working across the sort of background noise, right? So you could even just think of something like Mexico, right? Lots of political noise about the wall, but the agents in both Mexico and the United States at the border are working cooperatively. And so no surprise here, the same is true across intelligence agencies. Just once again, what is just completely unique, I think that's safe to say, is the extent to which that this would have been disclosed so publicly by not just Putin, but then, of course, Trump, who followed up with a statement as well.
And any thoughts about that? Why this would have been made so public?
No idea. I mean, I think that's where the conspiracy theories walk in about the extent to which this was a real attack, or conspiracy theories about the extent to which Putin sort of drives Donald Trump's agenda, whether it has to do with this or the election or anything else for that matter. And so it's just worth noting, though, that not only was it unique and somewhat ahistorical, but our response, the United States response, was very unsophisticated. In a statement by the White House following up on what Putin had disclosed, we sort of buy into his narrative. And in fact, the press release or the statement ends with an exclamation point, you know, a job well done exclamation point, which sounds like it's coming from Donald Trump's mouth. That lack of sophistication also makes this more and more curious. And also, just it's worth noting that autocrats like Putin utilize fear and the threat of internal unrest to gain more power. And I think that the United States should be mature, sophisticated enough, should have their eyes wide open, that we won't fall into that narrative. And I think with Donald Trump's statement, we clearly fell into that narrative.
Former Assistant Secretary at Homeland Security, Juliet Kayyem, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And before we go to the break, here's a preview of a story we'll have for you on tomorrow's show. Our Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler takes us to Miami, to the neighborhood known as Little Haiti. Some people there worry that they'll be priced out of their homes because of climate change. Little Haiti is built on some of the city's highest ground.
I was having this conversation with a friend about how this changes the market in this area, makes it more valuable. So now we're going to definitely get pushed out of here.
The buzzword is climate gentrification. We look into it to see if it's really happening.
If it's not happening now, it's going to happen. 10 years, 15 years, who knows? But it's going to happen much sooner than later.
We'll have that story here on the show tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. You hear us talk a lot about our show being a co-production of the BBC. Well, one of the perks of that partnership is being able to share with you some of the great material that our BBC colleagues produce that you're not likely to hear anywhere else, like this next story. It's from the BBC's history podcast, Witness, and it tells the story of an American hypnotist from Chicago who was invited to go to Iraq to treat a patient. It was 2001, 2 years before the U.S. invasion, and the thing is, the hypnotist, whose name is Larry Garrett, wasn't told who the patient was. Mr. Garrett told the story about what happened next to the BBC's Mike Lanchon, starting with why he accepted an invitation to treat an unknown patient in a dangerous part of the world.
Didn't really matter to me. I was just told I would be treating a businessman, that he had a physical injury, and that the injury had caused an emotional reaction. So they asked if I could possibly work with this, and I said I could. And of course, within the next 2 or 3 weeks, I was told by many people how dangerous it was. I wouldn't come back. I probably would be killed. And I figured, well, if they're inviting me there, I probably would be safe.
Iraq was a dangerous place at the time, at least for most Westerners. After Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait and the first Gulf War, international sanctions were in place against the regime, and so Larry needed to get special clearance from the US government to travel. His Iraqi contacts sent him a plane ticket, and in May of 2001, he boarded a flight to Jordan, where he was met and then driven through the desert to Baghdad. It was only then that he was finally told his patient's true identity, Uday Hussein, the eldest son of the Iraqi leader.
Immediately, I felt a kind of tightness in my body. I'm now 10,000 miles from home, trapped in another country, going to hypnotize one of the worst people in the world.
In 1996, an Iraqi television newsreader gave details of what he called a cowardly assassination attempt on Uday Hussein, which left the 32-year-old practically unable to walk. Uday was Saddam's heir apparent and was renowned for his love of women, fast cars and violence. He was briefly imprisoned by his father for one murder, and the story goes that he had the players of the national soccer team beaten and tortured after they'd failed to qualify for the World Cup. Soon after Larry arrived in the Iraqi capital, he was woken in the middle of the night and taken to meet Uday at a top security hospital. Uday came in, surrounded by an entourage of doctors and bodyguards.
When he walked in a room, it was like God walked in the room to these other people. They would immediately stand erect and straight. They would immediately greet him with an admiration and a respect. But I found out later it was mostly fear.
And what did he say to you?
He came right up to me and greeted me and told me thank you for being there. And he was honored that I was able to come. And then we sat down and waited another half hour until I was able to hypnotize him the first time.
On the face of it, Larry's task seemed fairly simple, to use hypnotism to remove the anxiety that Uday's doctors said was preventing him from walking again after the assassination attempt. But what fascinates me most about this story is how Larry dealt with the huge gulf that existed between the two men.
Uday was about 38 years old, 39 years old when I met with him, so he'd be about the age of one of my sons. So instead of him viewing me as this American who he may have not felt total respect with, instead of me viewing him as some terrorist and murderer and rapist, I viewed him as nothing more than a scared child who wanted to improve his ability to walk, and he viewed me as nothing more than a person who was going to help him. So we did create this relationship almost immediately. And by the third session, he was able to walk upstairs without hesitation.
And that was through the suggestion to him that it was all right to walk normally.
That's right. Simple terms, it was nothing more than me distracting this conflict between his logic and his emotions.
Did you ever talk to him about, I mean, did you mention any of the accusations against him? Or?
Never, never. It wasn't an issue. And I didn't feel it would be appropriate. If I did mention something like that, I probably would have set off a cannon. Because remember, this man was in a precarious state of feeling inadequate. You don't want to take a person who is violent, who's feeling inadequate, and then tell them something bad about them. You want to give them reassurance.
It was more a clinical, if you like, a clinical decision rather than a moral decision.
It was both. I have a philosophy, Mike, that says, say only what they want to hear without lying. So we can't lie. I couldn't. If he said to me, have you heard of my background? In fact, at one point, I think he did. And I says, yes, I did. And he says, does that bother you? And I said, nope, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother you. He said to me, he says, you're not nervous to be here, are you? And I said, of course not. Why would I be nervous to be here?
But was that true?
No, I wasn't nervous at all.
Many of their sessions and conversations took place in the bedroom of Uday's spacious and luxurious home.
There was a big painting hanging above his bed of a warrior with a big sword in his hand, protecting this woman from this large bird that was trying to attack her. And I always thought about how that was his way of showing how strong he would like to be.
In early September 2001, Larry was asked to return to Baghdad for a second time to continue the treatment. And he was there when the terrible news broke of the attacks on New York and Washington on September the 11th. That same afternoon, he was taken to see Uday.
His words were, you know, your country is going to blame our country for this. I couldn't understand that at the time, and of course we see later how it turned out. And I had mentioned to him, maybe we could make a video of you extending your condolences to our country. And he said, let me speak to you about that. So later on that evening, we had a conversation. He thought that was not a good idea.
Do you think you were being naive by taking him at face value?
I'm not a very naive person. I'm very aware of human nature. I'm very aware of who people are, if they're good or bad, if they're going to hurt me or not. So I don't think that I was naive, but I think that people who would have fears would think I was naive, yes.
So how well do you think you really knew Uday?
Oh, boy, I knew him well. Uday really enjoyed talking to me because I think I was one of the very few people who was not either fearful of him or judging him.
A week after the 9/11 attacks, Larry returned home. Less than 2 years later, in July of 2003, Uday and his younger brother Qusay died in a shootout with US forces that had invaded Iraq to depose their father, Saddam Hussein. Meanwhile, Larry continued practicing hypnotism in Chicago. He later wrote a book about his experiences in Iraq. Despite receiving a lot of criticism for having treated the son of an enemy of the United States, Larry says that he has few regrets.
I had this silly fantasy I may have written in my book that I thought by me being invited to a country that at that time we weren't friendly with might actually create some closeness between the two countries. I know it sounds silly, but it doesn't take more than one person some time to change the world.
And do you feel that looking back, it was the right decision and you would do the same again?
I would do it in a flash.
The BBC's Mike Langen there speaking with hypnotist Larry Garrett, recalling his time in Iraq in 2001, treating Saddam Hussein's oldest son, Uday. I'm Marco Werman. Iceland wants to be carbon neutral by 2040, and to get there, it's re-examining every part of the country's economy.
We are, for example, now starting a project with sheep farmers on how we can do sheep farming carbon neutral.
Iceland's new prime minister talks climate, bicycle commuting, and much, much more. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here are two words I never thought of together until just recently, gangs and Nantucket. But the federal government believes there is gang activity on this exclusive island off our shores here in Massachusetts. And last year, agents arrested five people there who they say were associated with two rival gangs, MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang. The gangs are linked to Salvadoran immigrants to the U.S., and President Trump talks about them a lot when he brings up his immigration crackdown. But the feds have been targeting them for a long time, and some critics say they're missing their target and arresting innocent people. My colleague Philip Martin here at WGBH in Boston has dug into the arrest of one of the alleged gang members on Nantucket, and he'll be bringing us two stories this week. So, Philip, what happened on Nantucket that took you there to report these stories?
Well, Marco, think about Nantucket as one of these resort places. People head there for fun in the sun and for good eating and for bike riding and for having a vacation. You have a situation where Immigration Customs Enforcement agents have been going back and forth to Nantucket for some time now. And one of the trips they took in May of 2016 was to pick up suspected members of MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang.
So your reporting focuses on one person in particular, Henry Lemus Calderon. Tell us about him.
Henry Lemus Calderon is a now 19-year-old who came to the United States when he was 16. He crossed from El Salvador, made his way to the U.S.-Mexico border at a time when unaccompanied minors like him were crossing into the country. And he, with the help of his uncle, made his way to Nantucket, where his uncle lives. Now, he is someone who, fellow students, he admits they're afraid of him because, you know, he has this persona of a tough guy. But he also was a kid who's number one in algebra at Nantucket High School, sang in the church choir, worked a number of construction jobs, and worked caring for young members of his family. He was accused of being a member of the 18th Street Gang.
And his is the story we're going to hear in part one of these two stories you're going to tell us this week. I just have one question, though. I mean, he is part of a growing Central American immigrant community on Nantucket, right? I mean, what is the draw to live in this part of the U.S.?
Work. When you think about folks needing everything on Nantucket that they don't do themselves, rich people, we're talking about carpentry, we're talking about driving cabs, we're talking about janitorial work, we're talking about restaurant work. You have about 3,000 Salvadorans who've made their way to Nantucket. You also have Guatemalans and Hondurans, and many escaping civil war and gang violence. This is Henry Calderon's story, or the story of his family.
Calderon, just to clarify, he's undocumented?
He is undocumented, and that is a basis for his continued detention.
All right, Philip, thanks a lot. Let's listen to part one of your story about Calderon.
Henry Lemus Calderon, by his own admission, was not a choir boy, even though he sang in one. He attended Faro de Luz Church on Nantucket, where the Reverend Rigoberto Lemus presides. Lemus, no relation to Henry, says Calderon spent a lot of time here.
We'd have a service Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday, and he always come those days. And he always voluntary to open the door, receive the brothers and sisters, and is a good person.
Calderon says he fled El Salvador in 2014, after 18th Street gang members demanded monthly payments in exchange for his life. He crossed the U.S.-Mexico border on foot and made his way to Nantucket, where his uncle Rodolfo Lemus lives. Soon, Calderon enrolled in Nantucket High. His cousin, Jocelyn Ramirez, says he was a good student.
He won excellence awards like in his first few months of being here, and he barely spoke English, and he was already getting awards and doing so well in school.
But a year after arriving on Nantucket, a police officer assigned to the school sketched a very different portrait of Calderon. The report tagged him as a member of the 18th Street Gang, the very gang he said he fled in El Salvador. Calderon, now in an immigrant detention center, says the officer made a mistake. His shackles clatter as he speaks.
Porque me vio así con esas personas haciendo amistad y pensó que yo era pandillero también.
He thought I was a gangster because I hung out with guys who may have been, says Calderon. A school official and a teacher accused Calderon of threatening to beat up another student, a self-identified member of the rival MS-13 gang. They also accused Calderon of marking the school bathroom with the words in Spanish, "The gang never dies." Calderon says he didn't write that. His attorney, Zola Gomez, says the allegations are based on circumstantial evidence.
If you look at his background and the record, it just doesn't add up.
Gomez also points out that while he may have threatened a student, he didn't assault anyone. And she says he didn't dress like a gang member and didn't have gang tattoos. But Chris Cronin with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in Massachusetts, says traditional gang markers have changed.
In the past, there would be tattoos that were, you know, overt, and everybody could see them if somebody was wearing a T-shirt.
Cronin says Central American gangs, including those on Nantucket, have resorted to more subtle ways of demonstrating membership.
So it is challenging identifying folks that are part of gangs in today's world.
But what happens when some identify themselves as gang members, as several young men at Nantucket High School apparently did? Calderon says he was not one of them, but one of his friends openly bragged.
Solo porque me juntaba con un amigo que pienso que era pandillero.
Calderon says he thinks his friend was an 18th Street gang member. And so Nantucket Police Lieutenant Angus McVicker says it's simple.
If they're going to go ahead and identify themselves, then we're going to treat them as that.
That's a problem, says Lisa Thoreau, an attorney at Strategies for Youth, which focuses on improving police-youth relations. She says what might ordinarily be written off as teenage bravado is being taken to a new level by law enforcement with life-altering consequences.
On Nantucket, you have a perfect storm of school resource officers having to address normative behaviors of youth intersecting with Homeland Security investigations, which has the agenda of trying to rid this country of people they see undesirable. And it appears that the lines aren't clear about what level of proof is necessary.
Nantucket police vehemently deny that its officers engage in ethnic profiling. But one resident, Fernando Ramos, believes that young Salvadorans are tagged as gang members more than other students. Ramos and Calderon used to eat lunch together. Ramos is convinced that the gang label attached to Calderon is based in part on people at school seeing Central Americans hanging out.
You know, so many white people are with their white groups and Hispanics with the Hispanics. You know, so like, in his case, he didn't speak any English and he straight out came from El Salvador. So obviously, kids are going to see him as a different. So he sees the first person that he knows. Obviously, they speak Spanish.
Calderon has other supporters, too. A local teacher and an artist filed affidavits with Immigration Court in Boston on behalf of Calderon. Meanwhile, Calderon is being held at the Bristol County Jail in an area reserved for immigrants and hardcore gang members. Calderon's uncle, Isidro Lemus, worries about his safety.
He got involved in a fight with a gang member the other day because they say that he don't want to go with them outside and everything, talk to them. And Henry was like, listen, you know, I'm not part of this whole thing. I'm here because they're accusing me of being with you guys. So there's like no way I'm going to get involved. I'd rather die before do something stupid like that.
But Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, who runs the Bristol County Jail, takes ICE's word that Calderon is a gang member and a threat to the residents of Nantucket. And that's why he's here.
It wouldn't make sense to put somebody in a situation like that where they would get targeted if they really weren't part of a gang.
Calderon's supporters, however, insist that he has been caught up in a federal crackdown on gangs. For The World, I'm Philip Martin.
Tomorrow, more from Nantucket and what the case of Henry Lemus Calderon might tell us about who's targeted for arrest by ICE and why. So, gangs on Nantucket. Let's go to another place with a side we don't hear a lot about. If you know the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri, you probably have heard of the extremist group that was born there, Boko Haram. The group has terrorized the region for years in pursuit of its harsh version of Islam. Maiduguri has been scarred by conflict, especially violence against women. But there is another side to the city. As New York Times correspondent Dion Searcy discovered on a recent visit to a lecture hall at Maiduguri's main university.
One student rose up and told me, you know, I want a husband who does the dishes. I don't want to be the one who always has to go to the marketplace. I want a husband who will make me breakfast.
Is this people in Maiduguri adapting to a new reality and kind of being more forceful, or has this always kind of been the case and we just haven't heard about it?
I think Maiduguri has been a really cosmopolitan, inclusive city for a long time. It's a regional trade capital. It's a college town. You know, there are a lot of universities there. So it's always had a very broad-minded sort of youth culture. And I think we just have forgotten about it for a long time because the war, obviously, with Boko Haram has dominated so much of the news coverage and so much of daily life there.
We're talking, though, about radical feminism, the end of patriarchy, and husbands who do the dishes. Is there any kind of backlash in Maiduguri against the women who are advocating for these things?
Like any society, Maiduguri has, you know, a conservative element to it, but also young people who are watching TV and looking at the internet and reading stories about what's going on in other places, and they want a more liberal future for themselves. I mean, I would say half of the students in the class that I went to were women. I mean, there are a lot of career women. I went to a lot of, you know, dating spots in Maiduguri, and women told me that they didn't want a boyfriend. They wanted to focus on their careers. And that's in some ways a function of a wartime economy where everybody needs to pitch in. But it's just also a sign that this is a modern community.
And not only is Maiduguri the birthplace of Boko Haram, but it is a college town with a party scene. You went to some nightclubs, too, that are popular with young middle-class women.
Absolutely. I did go to some nightclubs and some bars and went to an all-night lock-in party, which, you know, gets closed down from time to time.
What is a lock-in party?
Well, there's a curfew in Maiduguri right now. So every night, you know, you have to be inside. Different parts of the city have different times, but there are hotels that every now and then host a lock-in party where young men and women will come in, the party will really get going at about 8 o'clock, and then the gates swing shut and everyone's there for the night because they're not allowed to be out. So it's this enforced all-night dance party.
Yeah, so what are the real dangers?
The dangers are suicide bombings. I mean, there are often bombings right at dawn, you know, right before daybreak at a lot of different places in Maiduguri, at marketplaces, at a polo field, at mosques, and at the very gates of the university where this radical feminism lecture was taking place.
So these women are not all about landing a husband. They are about being liberated women and finding boyfriends and premarital sex, right?
I think we have some picture of societies, you know, here, especially one in the middle of this extreme movement, this harsh interpretation of Islam, you know, where that has bubbled up, that these women don't want the same things that women do in America, in Europe, and anywhere. And absolutely they do.
And the women you met at the university in Maiduguri, a mix of Christian and Muslim women?
That's exactly right. I mean, the city is mostly Muslim, but in this class, there was a good mix of Muslim and Christian. I think the city is probably about 20% Christian. But, you know, it being a trading capital, it's pretty used to having people from all ethnicities and all religions come through. But the north of Nigeria generally is largely Muslim.
I'd like you to tell us about just one couple you met and their kind of attitude toward their life, their future, Kefas Ilya and Ruth Joseph.
Mm-hmm. They were a really sweet couple, and Kefas had told me that he just really wants a dual career household. She's studying environmental biology, and he's doing his work in public administration, and he has this whole vision. They had their whole lives mapped out where they would both be working, and he was going to, you know, they wanted a family, but he planned to take care of the baby. He wanted to change diapers. He wanted to do the dishes. He wanted to help cooking and cleaning and that kind of thing. He was really into having a very, what I guess we would say, a modern marriage with a two working family where the man pitches in.
How does Ruth Joseph talk about the threat of Boko Haram and how that might kind of interfere with their plans for the future?
I think the war is an underlying layer of, you know, anxiety for everybody. But I think the sense in Maiduguri right now is that things are hopefully, you know, getting a little bit better. I mean, they had a really brutal year of suicide bombings that seems to have let up a little bit for now. So I think there's just a lot of hope and not a lot of dwelling on, you know, the war. And the fact that the university is open, markets are open, you know, the streets in Maiduguri are packed with people. There's a dance troupe that's, you know, practicing every day at an open-air theater, amphitheater. It's just a really vibrant, exciting place right now.
Dion Searcy, the West Africa Bureau Chief for The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Searcy is based in Senegal to the west of Nigeria. That's where she joined us from. So as long as we're there, let's check in with Ibaku. He's a music producer and DJ based in the capital, Dakar. And we caught up with him recently to talk about a couple of tracks from his latest album, Alien Cartoon.
So the name of the album is Alien Cartoon. And you're going to listen to the first song of the project. It's Djula Dance, which is a Senegalese rhythm from the south of Senegal, from Casamance, mixed with electro influences. And check this out. I became interested in music because of my family, because my parents were really into arts, music, and it became a passion. It became a passion to really understand what is behind the music that I was listening to. And I was really lucky because my father had a lot of books about Jazzman, the biography of Jazzman, so I was into it too. The song Monkey Boy is a song that Miles Davis might like because it's, there's a little bit of melancholy to it. I can imagine the mute trumpet of Miles Davis playing on it.
Senegalese musician Iba Ku telling us about his new album, Alien Cartoon. My next guest is a feminist environmentalist who wants to tax the rich and have her country take in more refugees. You could call her the anti-Donald Trump, but no, she is not someone you could vote for or against, in case you were wondering. That is unless you're listening from Iceland, where you may already have voted for her. She is Katrin Jakobsdottir. She's the new prime minister of Iceland, and she joins us now. Thank you very much for being with us. I want to start with your environmental pursuits and your mission. You recently attended the One Planet Summit in Paris, where you presented your goal to have Iceland carbon neutral by the year 2040. You've even predicted Iceland will achieve that 5 years ahead of other green countries like your Nordic neighbors. How far along are you already? Because isn't a lot of Iceland's energy geothermal? Don't you have a pretty good head start?
Yes, you could say that we have a pretty good head start since we are using renewable energy when it comes to, for example, heating of houses, because we have not only geothermal power, but also hydroelectric power in Iceland. But we still have a lot of work to do when it comes to industry, when it comes to waste process and other factors, other sectors. We are, for example, now starting a project with sheep farmers on how we can do sheep farming carbon neutral. So we are beginning to work with different sectors in society, but we think we can achieve it because we have this head start and we're such a small society, only 330,000 people. And to achieve that goal, we really need to get the close cooperation of local governments, of different sectors, and of course of the general public. But it's probably easier in a small country than a bigger one.
I mean, going carbon neutral typically involves dealing in carbon credits or offsetting carbon release by planting trees. You were talking about working with sheep farmers. What are you going to do with sheep farmers?
Well, part of the project is not only having less emission of greenhouse gases. When it comes to sheep farmers, they can play an important part in restoring wetlands, growing forests, etc., to achieve more carbon binding.
So, Prime Minister, you talk the talk and you also bike to work. Are you still doing that? I mean, can you make the case why politicians should cycle and not drive or be chauffeured?
Well, actually, now I'm being chauffeured, being a prime minister. And that's something quite novel to me. But I used to serve as a minister of education and culture. And then I used to cycle a lot. But now during the high winter, I'm not using the cycle. I will do that when it grows a little bit warmer again in Iceland.
Yeah, it is challenging. It is Iceland, after all.
Well, yeah, but we are actually using the bicycles a lot more than we did just 10 years ago. So we're also making changes. And a big part of becoming carbon neutral is changing the way we travel to and from work, how we can use more public transport. Then, of course, how we can, in spite of the weather, use the bicycle or travel by foot, which is actually the best way to travel, in my opinion.
I was watching a music video that you had a small part in about 20 years ago by a band called Bangang in Iceland. The song was called Listen Baby. I'm just curious, how did you go from that 20 years ago to education minister to now prime minister? What is the short version of that story?
Well, did you like the video?
I did. It's nice to see good old videos in black and white.
It was a great band. Actually, two friends of mine who asked me to play that role in it. I'm mainly doing the running bits, but in Iceland, not only being a politician, I'm also a literary theorist. I have worked quite a lot on research in crime fiction, and I also have done some pop music videos. And I also have three children and family, and it didn't quite stem directly from the pop music video. But of course, I've been a professional politician for 10 years and a member of government since from 2009 to 13. So we all have to play a lot of different parts, not least in a small society like Iceland.
Prime Minister, there are obviously many differences as leaders between you and the American president, Donald Trump, but there is an interesting parallel between the two of you. Neither big fans of NATO. There is no sign that he's carrying through on his campaign pledge to either get out of NATO or not fund it until other nations start pulling their weight. But you've gone on the record as wanting to pull Iceland's membership out of NATO. Isn't NATO Iceland's defense force, though, and are you prepared to abandon military defense for your country?
My party is against the membership of NATO. However, we are the only party in the Icelandic parliament that is of this opinion, and we actually got 70% in the last parliamentary election. So we decided actually to make a compromise on that, but that doesn't change our position in the matter.
Icelandic media call you the country's most trusted politician. We should point out that you're following scandals that have forced out two previous prime ministers. And now you've got a coalition, party members, centrist progressives and conservatives. Mm-hmm. Just describe the political mood in Iceland right now.
Well, the political mood in Iceland has been since 2008 when we were faced with the economic crisis, which hit us very hard. It was a great shock to the nation. And I should say that even though we have recovered quite well economically, we haven't quite recovered when it comes to the political situation, trust in politics or confidence in politicians. It's been very low. I've gone through five elections, so you can imagine the turbulence that's been here. So I think the political mood in Iceland is that people hope that all parties in parliament will be able to achieve better political culture. Mm. You know, we have eight parties in the Icelandic parliament now, which is more than ever.
On the subject of kids, Prime Minister, your children, all three are boys, and you've been described as an anti-war feminist. How have all the allegations of powerful men abusing women been discussed in your house? And how are you talking about this with your sons?
Well, my oldest son is 11 years old and my youngest is 6. But we talk a lot about gender equality in my house. You know, we have now, for example, the Me Too movement has been very visible in Iceland. And I think it's actually bringing to the surface a lot of things that haven't been discussed too widely in Icelandic culture until now. When it comes to sexual harassment and when it comes to women in politics, because that's a world I know fairly well.
You are the second woman prime minister in Iceland's history. What still needs to happen in terms of gender equality in Iceland? Like, where is Iceland falling short?
When it comes to international comparison, we're doing pretty good, but I still think we have a lot of challenges. For example, there are less women now in parliament after the last election than the election before that. We still haven't reached what we can call quite an equal pay between men and women, which is something that we have been working on for years now. You know, in my opinion, actually, we have done a lot of good things. We have introduced quotas in boards of bigger companies, and they have actually had some very good results. I could also mention when we introduced the parental leave, that is that all fathers need to take a paternity leave. It's not something that only mothers can take. So we have done a lot of good things, but there are great challenges ahead also.
Katrin Jakobsdottir, the new Prime Minister of Iceland, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Our interview came to us through our Across Women's Lives desk. So you must have caught there that among other bona fides, the Prime Minister appeared in a music video 20 years ago with an Icelandic surf band called Bangang. In it, she plays a femme fatale wearing shades. So let's take you out today with that song. We have our reality TV star. Iceland has its former rocker. Global leadership definitely is not what it used to be. And that's going to do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Is this a breakdown?
RI, Public Radio International.